Part 2. Basic Techniques in Analyzing Worry. Chapter 4. How to Analyze and Solve Worry Problems. I keep 6 honest serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who. Rudyard Kipling. Will the magic formula of Willis H. Carrier, described in Part 1, Chapter 2, solve all worry problems? No, of course not. Then what is the answer? The answer is that we must equip ourselves to deal with different kinds of worries by learning the 3 basic steps of problem analysis. The 3 steps are, 1, get the facts, 2, analyze the facts, 3, arrive at a decision, and then act on that decision. Obvious stuff, yes. Aristotle taught it and used it. And you and I must use it, too, if we're going to solve the problems that are harassing us and turning our days and nights into veritable hells. Let's take the first rule. Get the facts. Why is it so important to get the facts? Because unless we have the facts, we can't possibly even attempt to solve our problems intelligently. Without the facts, all we can do is stew around in confusion. My idea? No, that was the idea of the late Herbert E. Hawks, dean of Columbia College, Columbia University, for 22 years. He had helped 200,000 students solve their worry problems, and he told me that confusion is the chief cause of worry. He put it this way. He said, "Half the worry in the world is caused by people trying to make decisions before they have sufficient knowledge on which to base a decision. For example," he said, "if I have a problem which has to be faced at 3 o'clock next Tuesday, I refuse to even try to make a decision about it until next Tuesday arrives. In the meantime, I concentrate on getting all the facts that bear on the problem. I don't worry," he said. "I don't agonize over my problem. I don't lose any sleep. I simply concentrate on getting the facts. And by the time Tuesday rolls around, if I've got all the facts, the problem usually solves itself." I asked Dean Hawks if he meant he had licked worry entirely. "Yes," he said, "I think I can honestly say that my life is now almost totally devoid of worry. I've found," he went on, "that if a man will devote his time to securing facts in an impartial, objective way, his worries will usually evaporate in the light of knowledge." Let me repeat that. If a man will devote his time to securing facts in an impartial, objective way, his worries will usually evaporate in the light of knowledge. But what do most of us do? If we bother with facts at all, and Thomas Edison said in all seriousness, "There is no expedient to which a man will not resort to avoid the labor of thinking." If we bother with facts at all, we hunt like bird dogs after the facts that bolster up what we already think and ignore all the others. We want only the facts that justify our acts, the facts that fit in conveniently with our wishful thinking and justify our preconceived prejudices. As André Marois put it, "Everything that is in agreement with our personal desires seems true. Everything that is not puts us into a rage." Is it any wonder, then, that we find it so hard to get at the answers to our problems? Wouldn't we have the same trouble trying to solve a second-grade arithmetic problem if we went ahead on the assumption that 2 plus 2 equals 5? Yet there are a lot of people in this world who make life a hell for themselves and others by insisting that 2 plus 2 equals 5, or maybe 500. What can we do about it? We have to keep our emotions out of our thinking, and as Dean Hawks put it, we must secure the facts in an impartial, objective manner. That's not an easy task when we're worried. When we're worried, our emotions are riding high. But here are 2 ideas that I've found helpful when trying to step aside from my problems in order to see the facts in a clear, objective manner. 1. When trying to get the facts, I pretend that I'm collecting this information not for myself, but for some other person. This helps me to take a cold, impartial view of the evidence. This helps me eliminate my emotions. 2. While trying to collect the facts about the problem that is worrying me, I sometimes pretend that I'm a lawyer preparing to argue the other side of the issue. In other words, I try to get all the facts against myself, all the facts that are damaging to my wishes, all the facts I don't like to face. Then I write down both my side of the case and the other side of the case, and I generally find that the truth lies somewhere in between these two extremities. Here's the point I'm trying to make. Neither you nor I nor Einstein nor the Supreme Court of the United States is brilliant enough to reach an intelligent decision on any problem without first getting the facts. Thomas Edison knew that. At the time of his death, he had 2,500 notebooks filled with facts about the problems he was facing. So rule one for solving our problems is get the facts. Let's do what Dean Hawkes did. Let's not even attempt to solve our problems without first collecting all the facts in an impartial manner. However, getting all the facts in the world won't do us any good until we analyze them and interpret them. I have found from costly experience that it's much easier to analyze the facts after writing them down. In fact, merely writing the facts on a piece of paper and stating our problem clearly goes a long way toward helping us reach a sensible decision. As Charles Kettering puts it, a problem well stated is a problem half solved. Let me show you all of this as it works out in practice. Since the Chinese say one picture is worth 10,000 words, suppose I show you a picture of how one man put exactly what we're talking about into concrete action. Let's take the case of Galen Litchfield, a man I've known for several years, one of the most successful American businessmen in the Far East. Mr. Litchfield was in China in 1942 when the Japanese invaded Shanghai, and here's his story as he told it to me while a guest in my home. Shortly after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Galen Litchfield began, they came swarming into Shanghai. I was the manager of the Asia Life Insurance Company in Shanghai. They sent us an army liquidator. He was really an admiral, and gave me orders to assist this man in liquidating our assets. I didn't have any choice in the matter. I could cooperate or else, and the or else was certain death. I went through the motions of doing what I was told because I had no alternative. But there was one block of securities worth $750,000 which I left off the list I gave to the admiral. I left that block of securities off the list because they belonged to our Hong Kong organization and had nothing to do with the Shanghai assets. All the same, I feared I might be in hot water if the Japanese found out what I'd done, and they soon found out. I wasn't in the office when the discovery was made, but my head accountant was there. He told me that the Japanese admiral flew into a rage and stamped and swore and called me a thief and a traitor. I had defied the Japanese army. I knew what that meant. I would be thrown into the bridge house. The bridge house, the torture chamber of the Japanese Gestapo. I had had personal friends who had killed themselves rather than be taken to that prison. I had other friends who had died in that place after 10 days of questioning and torture. Now I was slated for the bridge house myself. What did I do? I heard the news on Sunday afternoon. I suppose I should have been terrified, and I would have been terrified if I hadn't had a definite technique for solving my problems. For years, whenever I was worried, I had always gone to my typewriter and written down two questions, and the answer to these questions. 1. What am I worrying about? 2. What can I do about it? I used to try to answer those questions without writing them down, but I stopped that years ago. I found that writing down both the questions and the answers clarifies my thinking. So that Sunday afternoon, I went directly to my room at the Shanghai YMCA and got out my typewriter. I wrote, 1. What am I worrying about? I am afraid I will be thrown into the bridge house tomorrow morning. Then I typed out the second question. 2. What can I do about it? I spent hours thinking out and writing down the 4 courses of action I could take, and what the probable consequences of each action would be. 1. I can try to explain to the Japanese admiral, but he doesn't speak English. If I try to explain to him through an interpreter, I may stir him up again. That might mean death, for he is cruel, would rather dump me in the bridge house than bother talking about it. 2. I can try to escape. Impossible. They keep track of me all the time. I have to check in and out of my room at the YMCA. If I try to escape, I'll probably be captured and shot. 3, I can stay here in my room and not go near the office again. If I do, the Japanese admiral will be suspicious, will probably send soldiers to get me and throw me into the bridge house without giving me a chance to say a word. 4, I can go down to the office as usual on Monday morning. If I do, there's a chance that the Japanese admiral may be so busy that he will not think of what I did. Even if he does think of it, he may have cooled off and may not bother me. If this happens, I'm all right. Even if he does bother me, I'll still have a chance to try to explain to him. So, going down to the office as usual on Monday morning and acting as if nothing had gone wrong gives me 2 chances to escape the bridge house. As soon as I thought it all out and decided to accept the 4th plan, to go down to the office as usual on Monday morning, I felt immensely relieved. When I entered the office the next morning, the Japanese admiral sat there with a cigarette dangling from his mouth. He glared at me, as he always did, and said nothing. 6 weeks later, thank God, he went back to Tokyo, and my worries were ended. As I've already said, I probably saved my life by sitting down that Sunday afternoon and writing out all the various steps I could take and then writing down the probable consequences of each step and calmly coming to a decision. If I hadn't done that, I might have floundered and hesitated and done the wrong thing on the spur of the moment. If I hadn't thought out my problem and come to a decision, I would have been frantic with worry all Sunday afternoon. I wouldn't have slept that night. I would have gone down to the office Monday morning with a harassed and worried look, and that alone might have aroused the suspicion of the Japanese admiral and spurred him to act. Experience has proved to me, time after time, the enormous value of arriving at a decision. It is the failure to arrive at a fixed purpose, the inability to stop going round and round in maddening circles, that drives men to nervous breakdowns and living hells. I find that 50% of my worries vanish once I arrive at a clear, definite decision, and another 40% usually vanish once I start to carry out that decision. So I banish about 90% of my worries by taking these 4 steps. 1, writing down precisely what I am worrying about. 2, writing down what I can do about it. 3, deciding what to do. 4, starting immediately to carry out that decision. Galen Litchfield became the Far Eastern director for Star, Park, and Freeman Incorporated, representing large insurance and financial interests. This made him one of the most important American businessmen in Asia, and he confessed to me that he owed a large part of his success to this method of analyzing worry and meeting it head-on. Why is his method so superb? Because it's efficient, concrete, and goes directly to the heart of the problem. On top of all that, it is climaxed by the 3rd and indispensable rule: do something about it. Unless we carry out our action, all our fact-finding and analysis is whistling up wind. It's a sheer waste of energy. William James said this: when once a decision is reached and execution is the order of the day, dismiss absolutely all responsibility and care about the outcome. In this case, William James undoubtedly used the word care as a synonym for anxiety. He meant, once you've made a careful decision based on facts, go into action. Don't stop to reconsider. Don't begin to hesitate, worry, and retrace your steps. Don't lose yourself in self-doubting, which begets other doubts. Don't keep looking back over your shoulder. I once asked Waite Phillips, one of Oklahoma's most prominent oil men, how he carried out decisions. He replied, "I find that to keep thinking about our problems beyond a certain point is bound to create confusion and worry. There comes a time when any more investigation and thinking are harmful. There comes a time when we must decide and act and never look back." Why don't you employ Galen Litchfield's technique to one of your worries right now? And write down the answers to these 4 questions. Here's question number 1. What am I worrying about? Question number 2. What can I do about it? Question number 3. Here's what I am going to do about it. Question number four. When am I going to start doing it? Chapter 5. How to Eliminate 50% of Your Business Worries. If you're in business, you're probably saying to yourself right now, "The title of this chapter is ridiculous. I've been running my business for 19 years, and I certainly know the answers, if anybody does. The idea of anybody trying to tell me how I can eliminate 50% of my business worries, it's absurd." Fair enough. I would have felt exactly the same way myself a few years ago if I'd seen this title on a chapter. It promises a lot, and promises are cheap. But let's be very frank about it. Maybe I won't be able to help you eliminate 50% of your business worries. In the last analysis, no one can do that except yourself. But what I can do is show you how other people have done it, and leave the rest up to you. You may recall that earlier in this book, I quoted the world-famous Dr. Alexis Carroll as saying, "Those who do not know how to fight worry die young." Since worry is that serious, wouldn't you be satisfied if I could help you eliminate even 10% of your worries? Yes? Good. Well, I'm going to show you how one business executive eliminated not 50% of his worries, but 75% of all the time he formerly spent in conferences trying to solve business problems. Furthermore, I'm not going to tell you this story about a Mr. Jones or a Mr. X or a man I knew in Ohio, vague stories that you can't check up on. It concerns a very real person. Leon Shimkin, a former partner and general manager of one of the foremost publishing houses in these United States, Simon & Schuster, Rockefeller Center, New York. Here is Leon Shimkin's experience in his own words. "For 15 years, I spent almost half of every business day holding conferences, discussing problems. Should we do this or that or nothing at all? We would get tense, twist in our chairs, walk the floor, argue, and go around in circles. When night came, I would be utterly exhausted. I fully expected to go on doing this sort of thing for the rest of my life. I'd been doing it for 15 years, and it never occurred to me that there was a better way of doing it. If anyone had told me that I could eliminate 3/4 of all the time I spent in these worried conferences and 3/4 of my nervous strain, I would have thought he was a wild-eyed, slap-happy armchair optimist. Yet I devised a plan that did just that. I've been using this plan for 8 years. It has performed wonders for my efficiency, my health, and my happiness. It sounds like magic, but like all magic tricks, it's extremely simple when you see how it's done. Here's the secret. First, I immediately stopped the procedure I had been using in my conferences for 15 years, a procedure that began with my troubled associates reciting all the details of what had gone wrong and ended up by asking, 'What shall we do?' Second, I made a new rule, a rule that everyone who wishes to present a problem to me must first prepare and submit a memorandum answering these 4 questions. Question 1. What is the problem? In the old days, we used to spend an hour or two in a worried conference without anyone's knowing specifically and concretely what the real problem was. We used to work ourselves into a lather discussing our troubles without ever troubling to write out specifically what our problem was. Question 2. What is the cause of the problem? As I look back over my career, I'm appalled at the wasted hours I've spent in worried conferences without ever trying to find out clearly the conditions which lay at the root of the problem. Question 3. What are all the possible solutions of the problem? In the old days, one man in the conference would suggest one solution, someone else would argue with him, tempers would flare, we would often get clear off the subject, and at the end of the conference, no one would have written down all the various things we could do to attack the problem. Question 4. What solution do you suggest? I used to go into a conference with a man who'd spent hours worrying about a situation and going around in circles without ever once thinking through all possible solutions and then writing down, 'This is the solution I recommend.' My associates rarely come to me now with their problems. Why? Because they've discovered that in order to answer those four questions, they have to get all the facts and think their problems through. And after they've done that, they find in 3/4 of the cases, they don't have to consult me at all, because the proper solution has popped out like a piece of bread popping out from an electric toaster. Even in those cases where consultation is necessary, the discussion takes about 1/3 of the time formerly required, because it proceeds along an orderly, logical path to a reasoned conclusion. Much less time is now consumed in the house of Simon and Schuster in worrying and talking about what's wrong. A lot more action is obtained toward making those things right. My friend Frank Betker, one of the top insurance men in America, told me he not only reduced his business worries, but nearly doubled his income by a similar method. Years ago, said Frank Betker, when I first started to sell insurance, I was filled with a boundless enthusiasm and love for my work. And then something happened. I became so discouraged that I despised my work and thought of giving it up. I think I would have quit if I hadn't got the idea one Saturday morning of sitting down and trying to get at the root of my worries. One, I asked myself first, just what is the problem? The problem was that I was not getting high enough returns for the staggering amount of calls I was making. I seemed to do pretty well at selling a prospect until the moment came for closing a sale. Then the customer would say, "Well, I'll think it over, Mr. Betker. Come in and see me again." It was the time I wasted on these follow-up calls that was causing my depression. Two, I asked myself, what are the possible solutions? But to get the answer to that one, I had to study the facts. I got out my record book for the last 12 months and studied the figures. I made an astounding discovery. Right there in black and white, I discovered that 70% of my sales had been closed on the very first interview. 23% of my sales had been closed on the second interview, and only 7% of my sales had been closed on those third, fourth, fifth, etc. interviews, which were running me ragged and taking up time. In other words, I was wasting fully one half of my working day on a part of my business which was responsible for only 7% of my sales. Three, what is the answer? The answer was obvious. I immediately cut out all the visits beyond the second interview and spent the extra time building up new prospects. The results were unbelievable. In a very short time, I had doubled the cash value of every visit I made. As I said, Frank Betker became one of the best-known life insurance salesmen in the country. But he was on the point of giving up. He was on the point of admitting failure until analyzing the problem gave him a boost on the road to success. Can you apply these questions to your business problems? To repeat my challenge, they can reduce your worries by 50%. Here they are again. 1. What is the problem? 2. What is the cause of the problem? 3. What are all possible solutions to the problem? 4. What solution do you suggest? Part 2 in a nutshell. Basic techniques in analyzing worry. Rule 1. Get the facts. Remember that Dean Hawks of Columbia University said that half the worry in the world is caused by people trying to make decisions before they have sufficient knowledge on which to base a decision. Rule 2. After carefully weighing all the facts, come to a decision. Rule 3. Once a decision is carefully reached, act. Get busy carrying out your decision and dismiss all anxiety about the outcome. Rule 4. When you or any of your associates are tempted to worry about a problem, write out and answer the following questions. A. What is the problem? B. What is the cause of the problem? C. What are all possible solutions? D. What is the best solution? Part 3. How to Break the Worry Habit Before It Breaks You. Chapter 6. How to Crowd Worry Out of Your Mind. I shall never forget one night when Marion J. Douglas was a student in one of my classes. I've not used his real name. He requested me for personal reasons not to reveal his identity. But here is his real story as he told it to the class. He told us how tragedy had struck at his home not once, but twice. The first time, he had lost his 5-year-old daughter, a child he adored. He and his wife thought they couldn't endure that first loss, but as he said, 10 months later, God gave us another little girl, and she died in 5 days. This double bereavement was almost too much to bear. I couldn't take it, this father told us. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I couldn't rest or relax. My nerves were utterly shaken, and my confidence gone. At last he went to the doctors. One recommended sleeping pills, and another recommended a trip. He tried both, but neither remedy helped. He said, my body felt as if it were encased in a vise, and the jaws of the vise were being drawn tighter and tighter. The tension of grief, if you've ever been paralyzed by sorrow, you know what he meant. But thank God I had one child left, a 4-year-old son. He gave me the solution to my problem. One afternoon, as I sat around feeling sorry for myself, he asked, Daddy, will you build a boat for me? I was in no mood to build a boat. In fact, I was in no mood to do anything. But my son is a persistent little fellow. I had to give in. Building that toy boat took about 3 hours. By the time it was finished, I realized that those 3 hours spent building that boat were the first hours of mental relaxation and peace that I had had in months. That discovery jarred me out of my lethargy and caused me to do a bit of thinking, the first real thinking I had done in months. I realized that it's difficult to worry if you're busy doing something that requires planning and thinking. In my case, building the boat had knocked worry out of the ring, so I resolved to keep busy. The following night, I went from room to room in the house, compiling a list of jobs that ought to be done. Scores of items needed to be repaired. Bookcases, stair steps, storm windows, window shades, knobs, locks, leaky faucets. Astonishing as it seems, in the course of 2 weeks, I had made a list of 242 items that needed attention. During the last 2 years, I have completed most of them. Besides, I have filled my life with stimulating activities. 2 nights per week, I attend adult education classes in New York. I have gone in for civic activities in my hometown, and I am now chairman of the school board. I attend scores of meetings. I help collect money for the Red Cross and other activities. I'm so busy now that I have no time for worry. No time for worry. That's exactly what Winston Churchill said when he was working 18 hours a day at the height of the war. When he was asked if he worried about his tremendous responsibilities, he said, I'm too busy. I have no time for worry. Charles Kettering was in the same fix when he started out to invest in a self-starter for automobiles. Mr. Kettering was, until his retirement, vice president of General Motors, in charge of the world-famous General Motors Research Corporation. But in those days, he was so poor that he had to use the hayloft of a barn as a laboratory. To buy groceries, he had to use $1,500 that his wife had made by giving piano lessons. Later, he had to borrow $500 on his life insurance. I asked his wife if she wasn't worried at a time like that. Yes, she replied, I was so worried I couldn't sleep, but Mr. Kettering wasn't. He was too absorbed in his work to worry. The great scientist Pasteur spoke of the peace that is found in libraries and laboratories. Why is peace found there? Because the men in libraries and laboratories are usually too absorbed in their tasks to worry about themselves. Research men rarely have nervous breakdowns. They haven't time for such luxuries. Why does such a simple thing as keeping busy help to drive out anxiety? Because of a law, one of the most fundamental laws ever revealed by psychology. And that law is that it is utterly impossible for any human mind, no matter how brilliant, to think of more than one thing at any given time. You don't quite believe it. Very well, then, let's try an experiment. Suppose you lean back right now, close your eyes, and try at the same instant to think of the Statue of Liberty and of what you plan to do tomorrow morning. Go ahead, try it. You found out, didn't you, that you could focus on either thought in turn, but never on both simultaneously. Well, the same thing is true in the field of emotions. we cannot be pepped up and enthusiastic about doing something exciting and feel dragged down by worry at the very same time. One kind of emotion drives out the other. And it was that simple discovery that enabled Army psychiatrists to perform such miracles during the Second World War. When men came out of battle, so shaken by the experience that they were called psychoneurotic, Army doctors prescribed "keep 'em busy" as the cure. Every waking minute of these nerve-shocked men was filled with activity, usually outdoor activities such as fishing, hunting, playing ball, golf, taking pictures, making gardens, and dancing. They were given no time for brooding over their terrible experiences. Occupational therapy is the term now used by psychiatry when work is prescribed as though it were a medicine. It is not new. The old Greek physicians were advocating it 500 years before Christ was born. The Quakers were using it in Philadelphia in Ben Franklin's time. A man who visited a Quaker sanitarium in 1774 was shocked to see that the patients who were mentally ill were busy spinning flax. He thought these poor unfortunates were being exploited, until the Quakers explained that they found that their patients actually improved when they did a little work. It was soothing to the nerves. Any psychiatrist will tell you that work, keeping busy, is one of the best anesthetics ever known for sick nerves. Henry W. Longfellow found that out for himself when he lost his young wife. His wife had been melting some sealing wax at a candle one day when her clothes caught on fire. Longfellow heard her cries and tried to reach her in time, but she died from the burns. For a while, Longfellow was so tortured by the memory of that dreadful experience that he nearly went insane. But fortunately for him, his three small children needed his attention. In spite of his own grief, Longfellow undertook to be father and mother to his children. He took them for walks, told them stories, played games with them, and immortalized their companionship in his poem, The Children's Hour. He also translated Dante, and all these duties combined kept him so busy that he forgot himself entirely and regained his peace of mind. As Tennyson declared when he lost his most intimate friend, Arthur Hallam, "I must lose myself in action, lest I wither in despair." Most of us have little trouble losing ourselves in action while we have our noses to the grindstone and are doing our day's work, but the hours after work, they are the dangerous ones. Just when we're free to enjoy our own leisure and ought to be the happiest, that's when the blue devils of worry attack us. That's when we begin to wonder whether we're getting anywhere in life, whether we're in a rut, whether the boss meant anything by that remark he made today, or whether we're losing our sex appeal. When we're not busy, our minds tend to become a near vacuum. Every student of physics knows that nature abhors a vacuum. The nearest thing to a vacuum that you and I will probably ever see is inside of an incandescent electric light bulb. Break that bulb, and nature forces air in to fill the theoretical empty space. Nature also rushes in to fill the vacant mind. With what? Usually with emotions. Why? Because emotions of worry, fear, hate, jealousy, and envy are driven by primeval vigor and the dynamic energy of the jungle. Such emotions are so violent that they tend to drive out of our minds all peaceful, happy thoughts and emotions. James L. Mercell, professor of education, Teachers College, Columbia, put it very well when he said, "Worry is most apt to ride you ragged not when you're in action, but when the day's work is done. Your imagination can run riot then and bring up all sorts of ridiculous possibilities and magnify each little blunder. At such a time," he continued, "your mind is like a motor operating without its load. It races and threatens to burn out its bearings or even to tear itself to bits. The remedy for worry is to get completely occupied doing something constructive." But you don't have to be a college professor to realize this truth and put it into practice. During the Second World War, I met a housewife from Chicago who told me how she discovered for herself that the remedy for worry is to get completely occupied doing something constructive. I met this woman and her husband in the dining car while I was traveling from New York to my farm in Missouri. This couple told me that their son had joined the armed forces the day after Pearl Harbor. The woman told me that she had almost wrecked her health worrying over that only son. Where was he? Was he safe or in action? Would he be wounded or killed? When I asked her how she overcame her worry, she replied, "I got busy." She told me that at first she had dismissed her maid and tried to keep busy by doing all her housework herself, but that didn't help much. The trouble was, she said, that I could do my housework almost mechanically without using my mind, so I kept on worrying while making the beds and washing the dishes. I realized I needed some new kind of work that would keep me busy both mentally and physically every hour of the day. So I took a job as a saleswoman in a large department store. That did it, she said. I immediately found myself in a whirlwind of activity. Customers swarming around me asking for prices, sizes, colors, never a second to think of anything except my immediate duty. And when night came, I could think of nothing except getting off my aching feet. As soon as I ate dinner, I fell into bed and instantly became unconscious. I had neither the time nor the energy to worry. She discovered for herself what John Cowper Powys meant when he said, in The Art of Forgetting the Unpleasant, "A certain comfortable security, a certain profound inner peace, a kind of happy numbness soothes the nerves of the human animal when absorbed in its allotted tasks." And what a blessing that it is so. Osa Johnson, one of the world's most famous women explorers, told me how she found release from worry and grief. You may have read the story of her life. It's called I Married Adventure. If any woman ever married adventure, she certainly did. Martin Johnson married her when she was 16 and lifted her feet off the sidewalks of Chanute, Kansas, and set them down on the wild jungle trails of Borneo. For a quarter of a century, this Kansas couple traveled all over the world, making motion pictures of the vanishing wildlife of Asia and Africa. Some years later, they were on a lecture tour showing their famous films. They took a plane out of Denver bound for the coast. The plane plunged into a mountain. Martin Johnson was killed instantly. The doctors said Osa would never leave her bed again. But they didn't know Osa Johnson. 3 months later, she was in a wheelchair, lecturing before large audiences. In fact, she addressed over 100 audiences that season, all from a wheelchair. When I asked her why she did it, she replied, "I did it so I would have no time for sorrow and worry." Osa Johnson had discovered the same truth that Tennyson had sung about a century earlier, "I must lose myself in action, lest I wither in despair." Admiral Byrd discovered this same truth when he lived all alone for 5 months in a shack that was literally buried in the great glacial ice cap that covers the South Pole, an ice cap that holds nature's oldest secrets, an ice cap covering an unknown continent larger than the United States and Europe combined. Admiral Byrd spent 5 months there alone. No other living creature of any kind existed within 100 miles. The cold was so intense that he could hear his breath freeze and crystallize as the wind blew it past his ears. In his book, Alone, Admiral Byrd tells all about those 5 months he spent in bewildering and soul-shattering darkness. The days were as black as the nights. He had to keep busy to preserve his sanity. "At night," he says, "before blowing out the lantern, I formed the habit of blocking out the morrow's work. It was a case of assigning myself an hour, say, to the escape tunnel, half an hour to leveling drift, an hour to straightening up the fuel drums, an hour to cutting bookshelves in the walls of the food tunnel, and 2 hours to renew a broken bridge in the man-hauling sledge. It was wonderful," he says, "to be able to dole out the time in this way. It brought me an extraordinary sense of command over myself." And he adds, "Without that, or an equivalent, the days would have been without purpose, and without purpose they would have ended, as such days always end, in disintegration." And note that last again. Without purpose, the days would have ended, as such days always end, in disintegration. If you and I are worried, let's remember that we can use good old-fashioned work as a medicine. That was said by no less an authority than the late Dr. Richard C. Cabot, formerly professor of clinical medicine at Harvard. In his book, What Men Live By, Dr. Cabot says, "As a physician, I have had the happiness of seeing work cure many persons who have suffered from trembling palsy of the soul, which results from overmastering doubts, hesitations, vacillation, and fear. Courage given us by our work is like the self-reliance which Emerson has made forever glorious." If you and I don't keep busy, if we sit around and brood, we will hatch out a whole flock of what Charles Darwin used to call the wibber-jibbers. And the wibber-jibbers are nothing but old-fashioned gremlins that will run us hollow and destroy our power of action and our power of will. I know a businessman in New York who fought the wibber-jibbers by getting so busy that he had no time to fret and stew. His name is Tremper Ongman. He was a student in one of my classes, and his talk on conquering worry was so interesting, so impressive, that I asked him to have a late supper with me after class, and we sat in a restaurant until long past midnight discussing his experiences. Here's the story he told me. 18 years ago, I was so worried I had insomnia. I was tense, irritated, and jittery. I felt I was headed for a nervous breakdown. I had reason to be worried. I was treasurer of the Crown Fruit and Extract Company. We had $500,000 invested in strawberries packed in gallon tins. For 20 years, we'd been selling these gallon tins of strawberries to manufacturers of ice cream. Suddenly, our sales stopped because the big ice cream makers, such as National Dairy and Borden's, were rapidly increasing their production and were saving money and time by buying strawberries packed in barrels. Not only were we left with $500,000 of berries we couldn't sell, but we were also under contract to buy $1,000,000 more of strawberries in the next 12 months. We had already borrowed $350,000 from the banks. We couldn't possibly pay off or renew these loans. No wonder I was worried. I rushed out to Watsonville, California, where our factory was located, and tried to persuade our president that conditions had changed, that we were facing ruin. He refused to believe it. He blamed our New York office for all the trouble, poor salesmanship. After days of pleading, I finally persuaded him to stop packing more strawberries and sell our new supply on the fresh berry market in San Francisco. That almost solved our problems. I should have been able to stop worrying then, but I couldn't. Worry is a habit, and I had that habit. When I returned to New York, I began worrying about everything. The cherries we were buying in Italy, the pineapples we were buying in Hawaii, and so on. I was tense, jittery, couldn't sleep, and as I've already said, I was heading for a nervous breakdown. In despair, I adopted a way of life that cured my insomnia and stopped my worries. I got busy. I got so busy with problems demanding all my faculties that I had no time to worry. I'd been working 7 hours a day. I now began working 15 and 16 hours a day. I got down to the office every morning at 8 o'clock and stayed there every night until almost midnight. I took on new duties, new responsibilities. When I got home at midnight, I was so exhausted when I fell in bed that I became unconscious in a few seconds. I kept up this program for about 3 months. I had broken the habit of worry by that time, so I returned to a normal working day of 7 or 8 hours. This event occurred 18 years ago. I have never been troubled with insomnia or worry since then. George Bernard Shaw was right. He summed it all up when he said, "The secret of being miserable is to have the leisure to bother about whether you are happy or not. So don't bother to think about it. Spit on your hands and get busy. Your blood will start circulating, your mind will start ticking, and pretty soon this whole positive upsurge of life in your body will drive worry from your mind. Get busy, keep busy. It's the cheapest kind of medicine there is on this earth, and one of the best. To break the worry habit, here is rule one. Keep busy. The worried person must lose himself in action, lest he wither in despair." Chapter 7. Don't Let the Beatles Get You Down. Here's a dramatic story that I'll probably remember as long as I live. It was told to me by Robert Moore of Maplewood, New Jersey. I learned the biggest lesson of my life in March 1945, he said. I learned it under 276 feet of water off the coast of Indochina. I was one of 88 men aboard the submarine Baia SS-318. We had discovered by radar that a small Japanese convoy was coming our way. As daybreak approached, we submerged to attack. I saw through the periscope a Japanese destroyer escort, a tanker, and a mine layer. We fired three torpedoes at the destroyer escort, but missed. Something went haywire in the mechanics of each torpedo. The destroyer, not knowing that she had been attacked, continued on. We were getting ready to attack the last ship, the mine layer, when suddenly she turned and came directly at us. A Japanese plane had spotted us under 60 feet of water and had radioed our position to the Japanese mine layer. We went down to 150 feet to avoid detection and rigged for depth charge. We put extra bolts on the hatches, and in order to make our sub absolutely silent, we turned off the fans, the cooling system, and all electrical gear. 3 minutes later, all hell broke loose. Six depth charges exploded all around us and pushed us down to the ocean floor, a depth of 276 feet. We were terrified. To be attacked in less than 1,000 feet of water is dangerous. Less than 500 is almost always fatal. And we were being attacked in a trifle more than half of 500 feet of water, just about knee-deep as far as safety was concerned. For 15 hours, that Japanese mine layer kept dropping depth charges. If a depth charge explodes within 17 feet of a sub, the concussion will blow a hole in it. Scores of these depth charges exploded within 50 feet of us. We were ordered to secure, to lie quietly in our bunks and remain calm. I was so terrified I could hardly breathe. This is death, I kept saying to myself over and over. This is death. This is death. With the fans and cooling system turned off, the air inside the sub was over 100 degrees, but I was so chilled with fear that I put on a sweater and a fur-lined jacket, and I still trembled with cold. My teeth chattered. I broke out in a cold, clammy sweat. The attack continued for 15 hours, then ceased suddenly. Apparently, the Japanese mine layer had exhausted its supply of depth charges and steamed away. Those 15 hours of attack seemed like 15 million years. All my life passed before me in review. I remembered all the bad things I had done, all the little absurd things that I had worried about. I'd been a bank clerk before I joined the Navy. I had worried about the long hours, the poor pay, the poor prospect of advancement. I had worried because I couldn't own my own home, couldn't buy a new car, couldn't buy my wife nice clothes. How I had hated my old boss, who was always nagging and scolding. I remembered how I would come home at night, sore and grouchy, and quarrel with my wife over trifles. I'd worried about a scar on my forehead, a nasty cut from an auto accident. How big all those worries seemed years ago. How absurd they seemed when depth charges were threatening to blow me to kingdom come. I promised myself then and there that if I ever saw the sun and stars again, I would never, never worry again. Never, never, never. I learned more about the art of living in those 15 terrible hours in that submarine than I had learned by studying books for 4 years in Syracuse University. We often face the major disasters of life bravely, and then let the trifles, the pains in the neck, get us down. For example, Samuel Pepys tells in his diary about seeing Sir Harry Vane's head chopped off in London. As Sir Harry mounted the platform, he was not pleading for his life, but was pleading with the executioner not to hit the painful boil on his neck. And that was another thing that Admiral Byrd discovered down in the terrible cold and darkness of the polar nights, that his men fussed more about the pains in the neck than about the big things. They bore without complaining the dangers, the hardships, and the cold that was often 80 degrees below zero. But, says Admiral Byrd, I know of bunkmates who quit speaking to each other because each suspected the other of inching his gear into the other's allotted space. and I knew of one who could not eat unless he could find a place in the mess hall out of sight of the Fletcherist who solemnly chewed his food 28 times before swallowing. In a polar camp, says Admiral Byrd, little things like that have the power to drive even disciplined men to the edge of insanity. And you might have added, Admiral Byrd, that little things in marriage drive people to the edge of insanity and cause half the heartaches in the world. At least that's what the authorities say. For example, Judge Joseph Sabbath of Chicago, after acting as arbiter in more than 40,000 unhappy marriages, declared, "Trivialities are at the bottom of most marital unhappiness." And Frank S. Hogan, former District Attorney of New York County, says, "Fully half the cases in our criminal courts originate in little things. Barroom bravado, domestic wrangling, an insulting remark, a disparaging word, a rude action, those are the little things that lead to assault and murder. Very few of us are cruelly and greatly wronged. It is the small blows to our self-esteem, the indignities, the little jolts to our vanity, which cause half the heartaches in the world." When Eleanor Roosevelt was first married, she was worried for days because her new cook had served a poor meal. "But if that happened now," Mrs. Roosevelt said, "I would shrug my shoulders and forget it." Good. That is acting like an adult emotionally. Even Catherine the Great, an absolute autocrat, used to laugh the thing off when the cook spoiled a meal. Mrs. Carnegie and I had a dinner at a friend's house in Chicago. While carving the meat, he did something wrong. I didn't notice it, and I wouldn't have cared even if I had noticed it. But his wife saw it and jumped down his throat right in front of us. "John," she cried, "watch what you're doing. Can't you ever learn to serve properly?" And then she said to us, "He's always making mistakes. He just doesn't try." Maybe he didn't try to carve, but I certainly give him credit for trying to live with her for 20 years. Frankly, I would rather have eaten a couple of hot dogs with mustard in an atmosphere of peace than to have dined on Peking duck and shark fins while listening to her scolding. Shortly after that experience, Mrs. Carnegie and I had some friends at our home for dinner. Just before they arrived, Mrs. Carnegie found that three of the napkins didn't match the tablecloth. "I rushed to the cook," she told me later, "and found that the other three napkins had gone to the laundry. The guests were at the door. There was no time to change. I felt like bursting into tears. All I could think was, why did this stupid mistake have to spoil my whole evening? Then I thought, well, why let it? I went in to dinner determined to have a good time, and I did. I would much rather our friends think I'm a sloppy housekeeper," she told me, "than a nervous, bad-tempered one. And anyhow, as far as I could make out, no one noticed the napkins." A well-known legal maxim says, "De minimis non curat lex," the law does not concern itself with trifles. And neither should the worrier, if he wants peace of mind. Much of the time, all we need to overcome the annoyance of trifles is to effect a shifting of emphasis, set up a new and pleasurable point of view in the mind. My friend Homer Croy, who wrote They Had to See Paris and a dozen other books, gives a wonderful example of how this can be done. He used to be driven half crazy while working on a book by the rattling of the radiators in his New York apartment. The steam would bang and sizzle, and he would sizzle with irritation as he sat at his desk. "Then," says Homer Croy, "I went with some friends on a camping expedition. While listening to the limbs crackling in the roaring fire, I thought how much they sounded like the crackling of the radiators. Why should I like one and hate the other? When I went home, I said to myself, the crackling of the limbs in the fire was a pleasant sound. The sound of the radiators is about the same. I'll go to sleep and not worry about the noise." And I did. For a few days, I was conscious of the radiators, but soon I forgot all about them. And so it is with many petty worries. We dislike them and get into a stew, all because we exaggerate their importance. Disraeli said, "Life is too short to be little." Those words, said André Marois in This Week magazine, have helped me through many a painful experience. Often we allow ourselves to be upset by small things we should despise and forget. Here we are on this earth with only a few more decades to live, and we lose many irreplaceable hours brooding over grievances that in a year's time will be forgotten by us and by everybody. No, let's devote our life to worthwhile actions and feelings, to great thoughts, real affections, and enduring undertakings, for life is too short to be little. Even so illustrious a figure as Rudyard Kipling forgot at times that life is too short to be little. And the result? He and his brother-in-law fought the most famous court battle in the history of Vermont, a battle so celebrated that a book has been written about it, Rudyard Kipling's Vermont Feud. The story goes like this. Kipling married a Vermont girl, Caroline Ballastier, built a lovely home in Brattleboro, Vermont, settled down and expected to spend the rest of his life there. His brother-in-law, Beatty Ballastier, became Kipling's best friend. Two of them worked and played together. And then Kipling bought some land from Ballastier with the understanding that Ballastier would be allowed to cut hay off it each season. One day, Ballastier found Kipling laying out a flower garden on his hayfield. His blood boiled. He hit the ceiling. Kipling fired right back. The air over the green mountains of Vermont turned blue. A few days later, when Kipling was out riding his bicycle, his brother-in-law drove a wagon and a team of horses across the road suddenly and forced Kipling to take a spill. And Kipling, the man who wrote, "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you," he lost his own head and swore out a warrant for Ballastier's arrest. A sensational trial followed. Reporters from the big cities poured into the town. The news flashed around the world. Nothing was settled. This quarrel caused Kipling and his wife to abandon their American home for the rest of their lives. All that worry and bitterness over a mere trifle, a load of hay. Pericles said 24 centuries ago, "Come, gentlemen, we sit too long on trifles." We do indeed. Here's one of the most interesting stories that Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick ever told, a story about the battles won and lost by a giant of the forest. On the slope of Long's Peak in Colorado lies the ruin of a gigantic tree. Naturalists tell us that it stood for some 400 years. It was a seedling when Columbus landed at San Salvador, and half-grown when the Pilgrims settled at Plymouth. During the course of its long life, it was struck by lightning 14 times, and the innumerable avalanches and storms of four centuries thundered past it. It survived them all. In the end, however, an army of beetles attacked the tree and leveled it to the ground. The insects ate their way through the bark and gradually destroyed the inner strength of the tree by their tiny but incessant attacks. A forest giant, which age had not withered, nor lightning blasted, nor storm subdued, fell at last before beetles so small that a man could crush them between his forefinger and his thumb. Aren't we all like that battling giant of the forest? Don't we manage somehow to survive the rare storms and avalanches and lightning blasts of life, only to let our hearts be eaten out by little beetles of worry, little beetles that could be crushed between a finger and a thumb? I traveled through the Teton National Park in Wyoming with Charles Seyfried, highway superintendent for the state of Wyoming, and some of his friends. We were all going to visit the John D. Rockefeller estate in the park. But the car in which I was riding took the wrong turn, got lost, and drove up to the entrance of the estate an hour after the other cars had gone in. Mr. Seyfried had the key that unlocked the private gate, so he waited in the hot, mosquito-infested woods for an hour until we arrived. The mosquitoes were enough to drive a saint insane, but they couldn't triumph over Charles Seyfried. While waiting for us, he cut a limb off an aspen tree and made a whistle of it. When we arrived, was he cussing the mosquitoes? No, he was playing his whistle. I have kept that whistle as a memento of a man who knew how to put trifles in their place. To break the worry habit before it breaks you, here is rule two. Let's not allow ourselves to be upset by small things we should despise and forget. Remember, life is too short to be little.